University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents freelance writer and columnist Craig Vetter, speaking on the topic, Bonehead Writing, Teaching the Lame to Walk. A former senior editor of Outside Magazine, Vetter graduated from the University of San Francisco in 1966 and has been writing short nonfiction articles and columns for 17 years. His articles, essays, humor, and interviews have been published in Playboy, Esquire, Look, Outside, Geo, and California.
I have been a freelance writer for about 19 years at this point. And I started on the staff of a small magazine in California called Sunset Magazine, a house and garden magazine, writing features like Bricks Underfoot, Apples of the West, was a very big story. And then went to a lifestyle magazine called Careers Today. It was back in 1969 when lifestyles were very hip. And that lasted 4 months. And then I went to New York and did a little freelance work for Look and Esquire and some other magazines, and then was hired as a staff writer at Playboy to write articles. And I did that for 3 years, quit, became a freelancer, and have been doing it that way ever since, with minor stops along the way, like this last one that Mary referred to at Outside Magazine, where I took a job as senior editor / staff writer. And went stark raving mad in about 4 months. Getting up in the morning was part of that, but there were other considerations too that I'll probably talk about. In all the 19 years that I've been writing, I haven't written a book. I've only written short form nonfiction, and I'm not sure why, except I just like it. It's one of the redheaded stepchildren of literature, no question about that. Stupid way to try to make a living. The only place that publishes it for the most part are magazines, and they don't pay very much for it. The good magazines, the big magazines, Playboy pays better than others, but magazines even like Esquire pay a pathetic amount of money for a huge amount of work. And you are, after all, working in this form, competing with everyone else who ever worked in the form, which includes most of the best writers in America. So I have done the hard thing, which is what the Jesuits urged me to do when I was in college and high school under them. They said it would make you happy if you took the hard shot rather than the easy shot. I'm not sure that's true. I'm especially not sure that's true when the rent comes due sometimes. And I don't have it. Short-form nonfiction is a lot like short fiction in that the main rule, if there is one and there are no rules, the main rule is leave it out. You only have 5,000 words at the most to say what you're going to say. And if you want to say it with any power, you're going to have to do it with economy. As time has gone on, magazines have shortened what they want from 5,000 words to 2,000 words. And that's decried as the product of our short attention span, the television age. It's always thought to be a bad thing. I'm not sure it is a bad thing. There's an old saying, and I don't remember who said it, which means it's really fallen into the usage, but it goes something like, I was going to write you a short letter, but I don't have the time, so I'll have to make do with a long one. Writing short is good for the soul and for the reader, especially if it's the product of a lot of hard work. About 3 years ago, Playboy magazine, for whom I've worked over the years as a freelancer, sort of gave me a chance to prove how much I liked writing short and writing often. And they offered me a column, 1,000 words every month, anything I wanted. And I took it and have been doing it ever since. And sometimes it's wonderful, and sometimes it's very, very difficult. One of those columns provoked my visit here. As a writer, like all writers, I suppose, I'm pretty sure, I hear from people, gee, you know, I really would like to write, I just don't have the time. And if you're a nice guy, you smile, and if you're not, you snarl. Because, of course, it bespeaks such a misunderstanding of what it takes to write well, how hard you have to work, and how nearly impossible it is, even if you practice it all your life. So someone asked me that question, or a question like that at a certain point when I had a column due, and I thought, I'm going to write a column about this. I had also noticed in the papers that various universities were instituting a program like the one you have here, which was to make all of their students as competent in writing as they possibly could before they graduated. A really noble goal, no question about it. But sort of stated as if it was just another thing you would teach them along the way. And those two things provoked this column. And it's a nasty little piece of work, actually, this column. I was in a mood when I wrote it. And some people, when they read it, said they thought it was arrogant. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, if you can picture a rat standing on top of a garbage heap, shaking his fist at a seagull, that kind of arrogance, yeah. So, I'm going to read it for you now. The rat takes the summit. And I'm going to interrupt myself, I think, at several places while I read this. Because when you write something, of course, it gets, there it is. Then it's in stone, so to speak. And you change, your mood changes. Besides that, there was a lot more you wanted to say. You only had 1,000 words. It'd take the wind out of it to get it into that space. And that's nice, but I'm going to put a little of the wind back in here because we're not limited to 1,000 words today. And then I wrote, there's a sort of a low moan that goes up periodically from the English departments at colleges and universities across the country over the fact that most students, even the good ones, can't write a lick, not a love letter or a suicide note, much less an essay or a term paper. It's nothing new, but according to the teachers who have to read this crap for a living, the further we get into the computer era, the worse it's becoming. So, at places like Harvard and Yale and Brown and Nebraska Wesleyan, they're holding faculty conferences to hash the problem through. They're designing bonehead writing courses and setting up special peer group tutoring programs in an all-out, last-ditch effort to ensure that their graduates will at least be able to fill out applications for day labor without embarrassing themselves. They haven't gone so far as to suggest that a student be required to write, say, one short, coherent paragraph in order to graduate, but there are signs they're getting a little desperate. For one thing, they're hiring more and more writers, and I don't mean just the cocktail party lions of big fiction either. They're actually cleaning out mop closets to make office space for journalists and other freelance grubs who have spent most of their careers below decks, sweating and wiping the greasy pipes in the engine room of the profession. Somehow, I haven't been asked. I am qualified, though. Added almost 20 years with nothing to show except a world-class alcohol tobacco habit, debt that follows me like a huge pet rat, and a small, used Olivetti with a leatherette case. Credentials, in other words. And I know some things about writing that others are not likely to tell you. Ugly things. I think I could cram most of them into the first lecture, which, given the size of the problem, would probably have to be held in a fairly large room. If I did it right, though, if I were honest with my students, I think we could hold the second class in a Datsun and get everybody in comfortably. So picture me now, cutting across the quad in my uniform, torn bathrobe, bolo tie, blown out L.L. Bean boating mocks, smelling like a ripe field of cannabis, making little Italian hand signals to the co-eds, then gripping the lectern and looking out into the small bay of faces that are waiting for me to teach them about writing. Good morning, children, and brace yourselves. This is Writing 1A. I wanted to subtitle it Writing for Those Who Still Sign Their Name with an X. But the administration said, no, these kids aren't stupid or uneducated, just writing impaired. I love that. Makes it sound like... It's not entirely your fault, though. I know that. All your lives you've been... there isn't one in 1,000 teachers who knows the first thing about writing. All your lives they've been reducing it to widgets and screws, clauses and semicolons for you, till what you think you're working with is a dainty sort of parlor art, something like embroidery. And I'm going to interrupt myself here for the first time. Not one in 1,000 teachers who knows anything about it. Now, I would pull back from that statement at this point. I come onto this campus, I've already met 6 people who qualify as folks who know something about writing, know a lot about writing, do it themselves, and write very well. So let's make that 1 in 100. And as far as it being something like embroidery, I had a professor when I was in college at the University of San Francisco who was the head of the English department, and he was a friend of mine, essentially. And he was very upset over the fact that I don't spell well. I didn't spell well then, and I don't spell any better now. I misspell some of the same words now that I did then. I don't do it with any particular pride because I've been hammered and pounded about this mercilessly all my life. And he was one of the people who hammered and pounded me. And he took me aside one day and he said, you know, there was pain in this man's face. You know, to write as well as you do and spell and punctuate as badly as you do is like showing up at a dance, a formal dance, in a tuxedo with grease in your hair and filth all over your face. I kind of like the image. But he was really trying to say to me, look, this is crazy. He also said, I'll tell you something else. There are people out there who can't do anything but spell and punctuate. And they're going to hold you down all your life. And that scared me. It really scared me to think I was going to be in the hands of copy readers, that I was going to be held back by copy readers all my life. He turned out to be wrong about that, though. There's a woman at Playboy who makes about $50,000 a year to correct my spelling. And she's very good at it. And there are women at all magazines who correct my spelling and other people's spelling. And they do more than that, too. Of course, they're copy editors. But that didn't hold me back. He later told a friend of mine just before I graduated, he said, you know, I used to think that people who couldn't spell were just being stubborn somehow and that you could finally teach them. But Vetter has convinced me that you can't. So widgets and screws, an awful lot of that goes on. You hand somebody a paper and the first thing they do is make a red mark and put SP above it. You know, and you go, oh good, this is going to be the kind of reading I wanted. So, writing is not embroidery. The truth is that writing is a blood sport, a walk in the garden of agony every time out, which is why those who are any good at it look older than their contemporaries, snap at children on the street, live alone like me. So you can pretty much forget the polite approach to writing in here. What I'm going to show you this semester is that you don't have what it takes to write well. You never did, you never will. In fact, you probably ought to think of this class as one of those wilderness survival courses that are popular these days. Except that instead of taking you out in happy little groups and encouraging you to face trouble and danger as a team, I want you to imagine that you're going to be hustled into deep woods at midnight, trussed up, beaten senseless, and left to die. If you do make it back to camp, we'll give you a nice T-shirt that says, "I survived the downward bound school of writing." You'll be rebeaten and then dragged to a less benign part of the forest. And if you think that metaphor exaggerates what's ahead of you, take a look at this. Don't turn away, you wormy little cowards. This is your enemy. A perfectly empty sheet of paper. Nothing will ever happen here except what you make happen. If you are stupid, what happens here will be like a signed confession of that fact. If you are unfunny, a humorless patch of words will grow here. If you lack imagination, your reader will know you immediately and forever as the slug you are. Or let me put it to you this way, and you may want to tattoo this somewhere on your bodies. Blank paper is God's way of telling us that it's not so easy to be God. But I'm not here just to give you the good news today. So let's get right to the ugliest of this morning's ironies. I'm stealing your money. I couldn't teach you how to write if I wanted to, if you wanted me to. Everybody who ever learned this wretched craft taught himself, and he did it despite the lettered fools who got into the process here and there, because writing is not first the gathering up and stringing together of words. Writing is thinking, which means that every time you sit down to it, you get another chance to find out just how perceptive you aren't. To come up with one simple, interesting, or funny thought on anything is the hardest, dirtiest shoveling any of us has to do, and no one can teach you how to do it. There is one trick I can give you, however, a way for you to seem smarter and more clever than you really are. All you have to do is spend 40 or 50 hours working up an idea, a sentence, that looks, when you have written it, as if it took 90 seconds to make. You don't have to tell anyone how long you were alone in your own weak mind, floundering and whining, that it took you 8 full days to write a dopey little 900-word column. But, and this is what I'd like you to ask yourselves before our next meeting, why in hell would anybody want to learn to do that? Well, that last question is the most interesting of all. Why? Why? Why would you do this to yourself? And I argued with myself over whether to tell you a Hunter Thompson story, because it always opens up dangerous territory and it forces you to admit complicity in things you might not otherwise want to. But I'm going to tell you a Hunter Thompson story. Hunter's an old friend of mine. We've known each other for 15 years, and we've worked together on several projects mutually and just generally have known each other and talked much about writing and other things. And once or twice, I've been forced to have a drink with him. A year ago, Super Bowl, Hunter was in Chicago because the Bears were playing in the Super Bowl. And although it was being held in New Orleans, he wanted to come to Chicago to cover it, watch it on television in Chicago among the people of the broad shoulders and that sort of thing. So he came into town, and we partied and had fun and took the various nerve salves and brain powders and other things that you usually take on those occasions, and had a fine time. And Hunter is now writing a column for the San Francisco Examiner and had a deadline for this particular column of the next day. And I left him at about 5 o'clock in the evening. His column was due about 5 o'clock in the morning. And we'd been having fun up to that time. We'd strolled around Chicago. We'd gone to various bars. We'd done a lot of things, just laughed and giggled the way we do, threatened innocent people. I got home and went to bed because I hadn't had any sleep for days, it seemed. And no one can keep up with Hunter, certainly not me. And I went to bed. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang and Hunter said, "Huh, it's not happening." And I said, "What's not happening?" I knew very well what wasn't. It's not coming out, this column. We talked about an idea for his column. It's not coming out. I said, "Well, Hunter, you know how these things are. Just get back." "Oh, I just don't think it's going to happen here. I said, "Well, do you want me to come down there?" "Well, I just don't see that it's going to happen any other way. That's all. I've fallen asleep over the typewriter here. I don't know. It's gibberish. I'm producing gibberish again. It's frightening. I hate it." So I said, "Okay, if this is really the only way it can get done, I'll come down there." I should say that Hunter's one of the few writers I've ever known who you can sort of work with like a sideman in a band. As a matter of fact, he needs a sideman, some distraction, something going on in the room to help him forget that he's writing. And I knew that's what I was going to be doing. I'd done it before, as have countless others. And I knew that all that was going to be required was my presence, and that I was going to have to stay awake, which was going to be tough. And I got there, and he was indeed at the typewriter, and he had two sentences written, which was what he had called over the telephone, "A pretty good start. I've got a pretty good start." And I read that. "Does that seem like gibberish to you?" Read the first two sentences. It wasn't gibberish. It was fine. And I knew basically what the column was going to be about. And for the next 3 or 4 hours, till 5 o'clock in the morning, when he called the examiner, I paced up and down the room behind him. He was sitting at a desk with a mirror in front of him in a hotel room, literally falling asleep, nodding off at the keys. And when he did, the electric typewriter would go, wake him up. And when that didn't wake him up, I'd go, "Hunter." He'd go, "All right, I'm here." And over this 3 or 4 hours, he slowly, painfully produced a column, pretty funny column. Claimed that Bishop Tutu had advised him against betting on the Bears. And at a certain point in this whole process, after we had just fortified ourselves against the horrors of sleep, he reeled back in his chair and looked in the mirror at me like this and said, why do we do this?" And I said something like, "Because we're not very smart, Hunter. Just shut up and write." And he did. He shut up and write. Finished the column, and I walked home at about 6 o'clock in the morning, 0 degrees outside in Chicago, steam coming off the lake, amazingly clear-headed given what I'd just been through, thinking to myself, "No, we don't do this because we're stupid. We're not stupid. We do it because nobody else would accept creeps like us unless we did something." Just about the time people are ready to write characters like Hunter or me off as hopeless drunks or fools, you sit down and do your trick. You write. But the pain of it, standing there behind Hunter, watching him go through his pain, was almost as good as going through it myself. It's awful. It's awful every time out. And I found a quote by Van Wyck Brooks the other day, which was one of those luminous little moments that lit it up for me, and said it as perfectly as anything I've ever read. It's out of a book of his that evidently works like a journal. I just found the quote. I haven't read the book, which is called Opinions of Alvin Alston. But the quote goes like this: "No words this morning. My brain feels like an old sponge battered by the waves and rocks of a dozen winters. In 30 years of writing, I have not gained an ounce of confidence. I begin each new book, as I have always probably begun, though I never remember it, with a sense of impotence, chaos, and desperation that cannot be overstated. I always feel that I am foredoomed to failure. Everybody, every day, I begin my work with the same old feeling that I am on trial for my life and will probably not be acquitted. That says it pretty well. That says it very well. But why should it be this way for Brooks and Thompson and me and you when you sit down to write? I tell people when they ask me at cocktail parties, come up and ask, well, how do you get started writing? I say, well, you sit down and you write the word I. And if that scares you, good. Any other word that you write when you sit down at your typewriter is artifice. Everybody knows it's you speaking, whether you write the word I or not. So they're always starting with the word I. As soon as you say that word, I think, I know, I was going, no matter how you say it, you go into a place that is hot, dangerous, stuffy. Often think of the cave painters 30,000 years ago. Used to go into these holes with a torch and then had to paint on the walls. And the very light by which they were working was making the air impossible to breathe. So no doubt they came out not very long afterwards choking, wheezing, crying. It's something like that. You get in there and the very thing that allows you to do what you do exhausts you, strangles you, beats you up. And, of course, you'll do almost anything to keep from having to go into that place, almost anything. I sometimes look at the Golden Gate Bridge and think, probably a guy who had a term paper due. What happens when I write the word I is there's a little voice, my editor. He lives in small, cramped rooms just above my eyes. He's a nasty little man, a Jesuit priest. Black cassock, dandruff on his shoulders, smokes like a burning bush, yellow fingers. You know. He doesn't like anything. When I sit down and write the word I, he says, who asked you? That's the first thing I have to get past. And then, this is a guy who remembers every nasty and disparaging thing ever said about any writer, especially me. Or any artist, for that matter. Every dirty shot ever taken at somebody who tried to do something creative, this guy has stored up, and he delivers them regularly. And I ordinarily hate him, and there are a lot of things you can do to try and put him out of business. And mostly what I have done over the years, although I've had to stop a lot of it, is I tried to drink him out of business and drug him out of business. Just get him drunk and go ahead and do it. Except he wakes up in the morning and sees what's been done and says, who did this crap? And that's a bad moment. So there's no way to put him out of business. You just have to stand up to him at every point, which is not easy to do, especially when you've written the word I. When I first took my job at Playboy, I was hired as the first staff writer, which meant I was going to be writing articles. And the managing editor, who was one of the sharks in the water around there, got the first piece I had written, which took me about 2 months to produce, and it was pretty short. And the comment that he put on it was, this is first person. It has the word I all through it, and Craig Vetter isn't exactly a household word. And I got that back, and I thought, oh, yeah, okay. I'm not, Clorox is a household word. Sign the damn thing F. Scott Clorox. Would you like that? But the point is that 2 months I was sitting in that office trying to produce this very small piece, I knew that was coming. I knew that was coming, plus a lot of other things. And the courage to sit down and write the word I and then follow it with whatever comes out really takes a brave fool. And both those things have to apply. You must be brave and you must be a fool. I've written here, you have to be willing to work like an athlete and worry like a mother. It pretty much says it. It takes a certain amount of athletic doing to sit at a typewriter and think for a long time. There's no question about that. There is a question of whether or not you can teach writing, though. And in the piece Bonehead Writing, I said I didn't think you could. And in a way, that's exactly right. I don't think you can, any more than you can teach a field of dirt to grow beans, you know. And if you can imagine a farmer saying, "See that field? I taught those beans." That's about what it amounts to. You can encourage it, and you can weed it. And my best memory from college is of a professor I had, a man named Dr. Lowe, who was so in love with American literature that to hear him speak on anything made you want to read it. And when you read that thing, you wondered where he saw all this stuff. But eventually he taught me how to see all that stuff. And I remember him speaking particularly about the way Hemingway could make you smell beans frying in a pan, without ever saying anything about their aroma or anything about your nose. For some reason, that stuck in my mind. But this man's passion for literature, the way he read, I already liked to read. It didn't occur to me at that point that I could be a writer. I wasn't fool enough yet. But his passion for literature meant more to me than I think any other single stroke while I was in school, and in a way taught me to write, as nothing else did. When I was an editor for Outside here not long ago, writers would ask me, I would be giving them an assignment, sometimes an assignment I had conceived, sometimes an assignment they had conceived, and they would ask me, "Well, how shall I approach this story? What's the story?" And you hate to hear that. What you say to them is, "Look, I don't know what the story is. I only know what the subject is. Go on out there. Find out what the story is. Then write the story. There's no angle. You can't go out there with any angle on this thing. Just go live with the story for a while. You find out. Go out there and pay attention like a Zen master would pay attention. Like paying attention was a form of prayer, because it is. And once you're full of this thing, come on back, sit down with it, sort it out, and I don't care what it is. If you can pull it off, if you can make it work, if you can make me feel a little juice about this thing, you've done your job, and I won't ask any questions, and I won't touch your work in any serious way. Just write the story. Don't give me a bunch of fancy language. Don't worry that you're writing it for a specific magazine. Go find the story. Tell the story. Everybody loves the story. Get away from the story in any way. Get into yourself. Get into something that doesn't belong in the story. You'll lose the reader. He knows instinctively when you've stopped telling the story, even for a moment. You can never let it get more complicated than that, but it's very hard to hold the simple courage of that. And if thoughts of money or your grade or anything else comes into your head, which they always do when you're writing, or the deadline that you're working for, that's miserable stuff. Not only do I want it, do you want it Tuesday or do you want it good? And the editor always says, both. That's what you signed up for here. All those things always come into your head. You have to find a way to blow them out. And the best way to do that is just to go back and say, what's the story here? Where's the story? How am I going to give these people the story? Because finally you'll spend the money. You won't remember the terrible worry. The grade will be long gone, of course. And all that will stand are the words. Teaching writing is dangerous in a way because you can do harm very easily. Very, very easily. Hard to do good, easy to do harm. When somebody hands you something, even the simplest piece of writing, it's all full of them, whether they know it or not, and they do know it. And what you say means a lot. The smallest thing you say means a lot. So there's a potential to do a great deal of damage. By the time students get to college, they've usually been beaten to a pulp on this level. The idea of sitting down with a piece of paper and doing something that's theirs, that they believe in, is a nightmare idea. Because somewhere along the line, somebody has said something that indicated to them that they were a fool. So by the time they get here, you've got them they're in very vulnerable shape. And if I were going to come up with a metaphor for teachers of writing, I would say, imagine that the Wright brothers have invited you out to the beach to see this thing of theirs, which is wire and bicycle wheels and widgets and things like that. And then they take off and they fly about 30 feet, about 2 feet above the ground, and they come back. Are you going to say to them, you know, that thing doesn't have much of a paint job? That's about what's happened to me many times in writing. When a student sits down to write, he's going to try to fly. And if he does it in any way, for 1 second, 1 inch off the ground, it's a miracle. Good writing isn't impossible, just unlikely. And something else about writing. Once you've finished a piece and published it and you send it out there, you can't anticipate the business that it will do. You just sort of put it in a bottle and pitch it in the sea. And then it has a life of its own. Sometimes that's bad. And sometimes it's very good. And when I wrote this Bonehead Writing column, what happened was, I got a letter from Mary Smith. And she was reacting to the fact that I had, partly to the substance of the column, that teaching writing was hard, and partly to the fact that I had said there wasn't one in 1,000 writers. We've now made that 1 in 100. There wasn't 1 in 1,000 writer teachers who knew the first thing about writing. And I'd always had a joke with my editor about columnists. I said, you know, I'm not going to become a columnist and print my mail. I hate columnists who print their mail. I think it's cheap, sleazy, easy. I won't do it. And he said, great, don't do it. Then I got this piece of mail. And I brought it into him and I said, I think I'm going to have to print this. And he said, he read it and he said, well, if you're going to get this quality mail, you're going to have to start printing your mail. In any case, I wrote a column called Man of Words around what Mary sent me, and I'm going to read you the whole column, including what she wrote. Several months ago, in a column called Bonehead Writing, I said I didn't think there was one teacher in 1,000 who knew the first damn thing about writing. Called them lettered fools and said some other mean things about the way they tried to teach their students to boil information and experience into written words. I had a lot of fun saying the things I did, and I still believe they're true, mostly. However, not long after the column was published, I got a letter that proved the exception, in spades. It was from an English professor named Mary Smith at Nebraska Wesleyan University. And besides showing off what she obviously knows about writing, she made a stunning personal connection for me with what she wrote. With her letter, she included a piece of prose, a short reminiscence about a man she'd lived with for the last years of his life, my Uncle Jim. Jim was a powerful character for me, though I seldom saw him more than once a year. Physically, he was a small, puckish man, and I don't ever remember seeing him without several books under his arm. They seemed to grow there, as did the bracelet of rubber bands around his wrist, which he used as place markers. He wore jeans, a jean jacket, and moccasins every day all year, and I remember stories about the trauma of buying him a suit so he could go off to New York to accept the first of 2 Edgars that the Mystery Writers of America awarded him for a column in the Chicago Sun-Times. Raymond Chandler presented him with that little statue, and in fact, the two of them for years carried on a spirited correspondence about the art of the mystery story. Brilliant was the word that was most often used on Uncle Jim from the time he was about 4 years old, according to my mother, his sister. And like many people who suffer that description, he seemed to me to be pretty much both blessed and cursed at the same time for as long as he lived. Mary Smith was clearly one of his great blessings. And it's hard for me to imagine that anything else ever written about him will catch his moody, impish spirit quite as perfectly as she has done in this small portrait she sent me. In her letter, she said that as student writers go, hers were pretty good at their routine assignments. Quote, they can fill out forms and write term papers in sociology and other lies, she said. Then she cut to the heart of the trouble with both writing and trying to teach it. My problem is to get them to be honest, to let the process of writing inform them how they feel and what they think. And it is painful. I wrote along with them to keep me humble. A couple of years ago, I told them to write about something that hurt or embarrassed them. I wrote about Jim. Here's a copy. It's untitled. He died 5 years ago in May, so perhaps it's time I tried to recapture him on paper, this man who shared with me the last 5 years of his life. James Sandow, James Sayer Sandow, son of a pencil salesman and an opera singer, Stanford graduate, actor, director, critic of the mystery story, wit, scholar, lush. He came to Lincoln after retiring from the University of Colorado to spend Thanksgiving vacation with an old friend and new lover. He stayed 5 years. Words danced for him, moved across the surface of his mind as his actors moved across the stage in delicate and intricate patterns. Above all else, he loved language. I remember him half drunk and wholly naked, leaping from the bed where he had been about to pay me proper attention to try once more for a perfect reading of Anyone Lived in a Pretty How Town. His priorities, as I told him, were always in order. I remember him best at night, talking, always talking, about Shakespeare, about acting, about the mystery story, about theater, about anything and everything that had to do with words. I remember his hatred of slovenly diction and his impatience with slovenly thought. I have seen him flinch in pain sometimes from the bright perfection of a phrase that sliced to the bone. Mostly I remember a fierce burning through the frailty of fierce joy burning through the frailty of the flesh. For the flesh was frail, battered by years of heavy drinking and heavy smoking. Yet when it became clear that the best gift he could give me was his continued existence, he gave up both at once and to the end of his life, even though the shock to his system was severe enough to hospitalize him for a time. He could be difficult, as we all can be. I remember days of surly depression as his books and papers began to arrive from Boulder, packed up and sent by his second wife, who had pushed him out of his house in despair of his drinking. As we sorted papers and shelved books and put his Indian rugs down on the study floor, I knew what was happening to him. Our whole amour was losing its charming sense of slapstick improvisation and taking on an alarming air of permanence, like those Quonset huts that went up on the campuses as temporary housing during World War II and stayed there forever, rusting gently under the ivy. But we could always talk it out, always laugh at ourselves and each other. A gift those 5 years, totally unexpected and undeserved. I, 44, he, 64, old enough to know better, a menopausal Romeo and Juliet. Grotesque, Jim called it, and wonderful. He loved words and he loved me in that order. When he lay dying in hospital, a mercifully short time, I read to him more for my comfort than for his, Prospero's great coda, Our Revels Now Are Ended. I had thought him in coma, but he was not, not yet. He looked at me for one last time and said gently, you could have sharpened the shading a bit. He had, as always, his priorities straight. And let me suggest that one of the other reasons you might want to take the time and work to learn to write is that if you work on it hard and for a long time, you might write something that wonderful someday. Thanks for having me here.
Today, University Forum has presented freelance writer and columnist Craig Vetter speaking on the topic Bonehead Writing, Teaching the Lame to Walk. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.